This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS, and the host for Place Matters. The city that FCS calls home, Atlanta, is a city of contradictions. Atlanta served as both the anchor for the Confederacy's economy as well as the heart and mind of the civil rights movement. Today, we have more black millionaires per capita than almost any other metro area in the country, as well as one of the greatest racial wealth gaps. The strength of Atlanta's influence on American and global culture through black art and music and innovation is so far-reaching it is impossible to measure. And yet, the forces that are pushing out and reducing black influence and legacy from our center city neighborhoods are constant and growing. Is Atlanta the epitome of what a vibrant majority black city can be, or of how the economic and racial gentrification forces are shaping the future of cities? And how are we still here? 60 years after some of our greatest civil rights victories, why are we still seeing exclusion and inequity? Joining me today to talk about the complexities of Atlanta is Professor of Urban Studies at Georgia State University, Dr. Dan Immergluck. Dan is the author of over 100 scholarly articles and 5 books that focus on housing, race, neighborhood change, gentrification, segregation, real estate markets, and the urban political economy. Listen in as we talk about his research and one of his recent books, Red Hot City, Housing, Race, and Exclusion in 21st Century Atlanta. Well, Dan, thank you so much for making time to be a part of this conversation. I have deeply appreciated your work and your book, Red Hot City, but also just following you on LinkedIn and the articles and the work and the things you're advocating for, as well as having the privilege of working with some of your former students. So it's good to finally meet you in person as someone I feel like I've learned and benefited from already. So just, yeah, thank you so much for making time to
Thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it. And I'm a longtime admirer of FCS. I think it's a really unique organization, not just in Atlanta, but in lots of places.
Well, it means a lot. Thank you for that. So I'm curious, before we talk about some of the great stuff in your book, what got you here? I feel like most people who end up caring deeply about cities and inequity and injustice and racialized harm, like, you don't just randomly wake up and choose that one day. So for you, how did you come to for this to be your passion, your work, your research? What got you here?
Well, it was an unusual path, I think. I went to college as an electrical engineering major a long time ago. My dad kind of pushed me that way. I was good at math. I got a small scholarship. And while I was at college outside of Chicago, I ended up living at a place called the College of Community Studies. And it was the early 80s, and it was during the time of the Harold Washington campaign, the first black mayor of Chicago, and really a revolutionary mayor in many ways, really pro-neighborhood, pro-low-income neighborhoods in particular, very kind of grassroots campaign. And my college, which was a residential college, I lived there, brought in lots of speakers from the campaign, and I was this engineering major, but I got really interested in urban studies. Some of the affiliated faculty with the college had set up a new urban affairs unit at the university. Mm-hmm. I was one of the first interns at a place called the Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago, which is now a fairly well-known large nonprofit. Yeah. And so I just got really interested in urban affairs, decided I actually co-op during college, which was great because I learned I didn't want to be an engineer. And nothing wrong with engineers. It just wasn't what I wanted to do. I went to grad school in public policy to try to make a transition, because having an engineer on your resume kind of makes it hard to break into things.
Yes.
Worked for the state of Ohio doing economic development for a couple years, but really what I wanted to do was community development. And my wife and I moved to Chicago, and I landed a job with a community development corporation on the west side, worked there for a couple years, and then worked for a nonprofit advocacy think tank around housing and community development in Chicago. So I was really a practitioner and advocate for about a dozen years. And then during that time, I got my doctorate at University of Illinois Chicago, and really started teaching and learned that I love to teach. And then eventually moved into full-time academics about 22 years ago now. And then came to Atlanta in 2005, so I've been here almost 20 years.
Yeah.
First at Georgia Tech, then at Georgia State. And I've taught mostly graduate students, but not entirely, undergrads as well. But really have had the pleasure, the honor to, probably teach 600 or 700 students over the last 20 years. Many of whom are still in Atlanta, but some are, many are around the country. And that first dozen years of practice and community development work has really grounded me, I think, and kept me interested in cities. So I think that's where my passion continues to lie. And I kind of find myself later stages of my academic career being more interested in policy and applied work than kind of going full circle a bit than in theory. Not that I don't value theory, but really interested in continuing to work on change and still focused on affordable housing, stable and affordable housing, but also on community development in ways that I think are wise, but both for my practice years and my academic work.
Yeah, that's what a fascinating set of events. Electrical engineer to this. That's not exactly the path most people follow. But it is fascinating. So FCS, which is growing rapidly, we're probably around about 50 or so staff members now. I don't think we have electrical engineer, but just about every, there's so many pathways by which people have woken up to the realities of how our cities have been designed and how inequitable they are, and kind of come to a moment like I can't live not in response to this. I've got to do something. So whatever the field becomes is some sense of how do we honestly deal with these realities, I think. So it's super, super fascinating. So I also came to Atlanta in 2005, and man, the rapid ways in which Atlanta has changed has been fascinating over that time, and we'll definitely get into some of that. So context of conversation, and what I love about your book is it's deeply about Atlanta, which is really helpful, because a lot of the things that I read, research, it's about nationwide trends on urban development and cities and neighborhoods, et cetera. And it's so rich to just get into the weeds of Atlanta's story and all of that. And so in some ways, I feel like your book is hyper specific to Atlanta, but in some ways I'm you could just take out the word Atlanta and drop Baltimore. this is this as it's played out in so many different places. I think a number of our listeners would agree that our neighborhoods have a history of inequity, right? And they're probably familiar with at least redlining, maybe contract sales, but maybe a few other kind of practices from the past that were racialized. And I think at best I hear people talking about where our cities are as a legacy of those bad racist decisions, which it is at some level. But what I don't hear people talking about, but what you did, was say it's not just a legacy of what happened in the 30s, 40s, 50s. It's still going on. What we're doing today is still designing and baking inequity into what's happening in our neighborhood. So there's a few phrases that you use in your book that I think are worth unpacking. I'd love to hear some thoughts on. So you talk about that neighborhoods are politically and socially constructed spaces. They're not impersonal decisions, right? So say more about what you mean about what does it mean that our neighborhoods, our cities are politically and socially constructed spaces?
Yeah, I mean, we sometimes think of the market as this magical thing that happens. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just something we have to respond to and address, and it's not people making decisions, it's the market making decisions. Mm-hmm. But what we know is that both at the city level and at the neighborhood level and at the household level, all kinds of decisions that we make politically and socially, but especially politically, and by political I mean policy decisions. I don't mean partisan politics solely, although that matters. But you know, what we allow in terms of how easy it is to evict somebody, what we allow in terms of how much affordable housing we produce for neighborhoods and what we do in that sense, what we allow in terms of the decisions we make of what kind of city we want and whether we put protections in place for families, whether we make sure there's affordable housing before we develop things like the Beltline, or at least that it's baked into it. Those are all policy decisions, and yet they're often the lack of policy that favors low-income families, that favors stability and balanced growth and, you know, economic improvement without displacement. The lack of those policies is a decision. It's not just the market. And markets operate in response and in the context of those policy decisions. You know, you guys have done amazing stuff in South Atlanta, and the fact that you have created a significant amount of homeownership and affordable housing is going to create a different response and a different context for market changes than in other neighborhoods that have much less affordable housing, don't have an FCS. That's a choice. The fact that we allow the city of Atlanta to continue to say, we don't have money for this, we don't have money for affordable housing, despite the tremendous growth in land values over the last 10 and 20 years, it's a political choice. You know, we undertax commercial property. That's a choice. That's not the market.
Do you feel like, so, you know, when people think about pre-Fair Housing Act, things that were done, I think Richard Rothstein helped to at least kind of make more into the public consciousness some of the things that have been done in the past, like very deliberate, proactive things were done to exclude. Do you feel like in this era, is it still proactive things, or is it just inactive? Like, there's just lack of good protections leaves us inequitable, or do you feel like it's both? Like, what?
Yeah,
what,
I think it's both. It's a good question. Pat, sometimes I've written other books. I wrote a book about the foreclosure crisis, and I talk about passive deregulation and active deregulation, meaning, you know, we kind of let mortgage companies, which are fairly unregulated, take over mortgage markets. We just let that happen and didn't regulate them like we regulate banks. The result is kind of the same, right? I mean, if you passively let things happen as markets change, if you passively let institutional investors buy 30% of a neighborhood in, you know, Henry County, that's going to have impacts. And it's, you could say it's an oversight, but no, it's an active decision to let that happen. So I do think in terms of the Fair Housing Act and you know, Community Reinvestment Act, the things that we kind of did in the late 60s through the 70s, mm-hmm. and even later, you know, part of it has been, have they been implemented in serious yeah. ways? You know, yeah. I mean, if you see a story like Stephanie Stokes' radio story on tax sales in Atlanta, property tax yeah. lien sales, and you see that they're all happening in black neighborhoods, predominantly yeah. black yeah. neighborhoods, you know, that arguably is a fair housing violation if yes. we really implemented fair housing law the way we could. Mm-hmm. She did a story a few years before that on what I call predatory equity, other people call equity theft, where investors mm-hmm. buy homes from often black older folks for much less than the homes are worth in gentrifying neighborhoods, and then mm-hmm. flip them or, you know, sell them mm-hmm. at much higher prices. We choose not to do anything about that.
Yeah.
That's a policy choice. We're letting that happen. Other cities are doing stuff about that. A lot of cities also aren't. But those are all policy choices, both in terms of passing laws, but also how we really view laws. I mean, just the property tax inequities in cities. It's not just Atlanta. I mean, Chicago has property tax inequities. We know it's kind of a national problem. Those are current policies going on that are arguably in violation of federal fair housing law if we had a more muscular approach. And obviously some of that is also a problem with, you know, how the courts interpret that. But some of it is also, you know, we don't have a fair housing agency in the state of Georgia. Many states do, right? Yeah. And as a
you can have a law, but if it's not enforced,
exactly.
Right?
If you don't really have the threat of being caught or of being, you know, prosecuted, then right, doesn't mean a whole lot.
Yeah. One of our team members was doing a presentation and kind of around some of these ideas, and she used a metaphor of, like, if you think of neighborhoods as tapestries, every single thread is a decision someone made, right? And I think, like, speaking of partisan versus political, I think depending upon which partisan group you're hanging out in, like, you might place the decision blame on government or the decision blame on capitalism or the decision blame on individual people with racist motives. Reality is, like, it's all of them, right? You're not going to, like, escape one of them. And this idea that your phrase of, like, the market inevitable fatalism, like, oh, well, housing prices are rising. That's just the way it is. Like, you get for us to kind of step back and go, okay, what decisions are being made politically, you know, financially, personally, like, who's making decisions that got us here? Because none of it has to be this way. Like, we're designing things to function in this very specific kind of way. As you see that in Atlanta, like you tracked both present and past, that there's this kind of consistent way that Atlanta has practiced development. You've called it the urban regime, and that has become, like, pre-post Fair Housing Act in the middle of it. Like, it really no difference. This has just been kind of how Atlanta has seen city growth take place. So tell us what you mean by the urban regime, and, like, how that's been problematic, or what have been the impacts of that approach to city growth?
Sure. And the kind of Atlanta urban regime model is not new. A fellow named Clarence Stone wrote about it about 30 years ago. And I revisited it in the context of my book, saying, you know, is it different? And I do think it's different in that metropolitan Atlanta is so much bigger that there are kind of regimes in different suburbs. Yeah. There are regimes, right? But in the city itself, I think the regime is still pretty much intact. And what I mean by it is that it's a partnership between, and this is the way Stone really described it, a partnership between kind of corporate Atlanta, often led by, still, by white leadership, predominantly white, often who don't live in Atlanta, right?
Right.
And And, you know, it's the Deltas and the Coca-Colas, those are the old ones, and now it's, but it's also large real estate developers, and even mid-sized real estate developers. But then the partnership that Stone talked about, which I think still exists, is with kind of what he calls the black power structure. And it's, it, you know, and that may be changing over time as the city becomes less black. But I think the modernization of it is the black power structure with the kind of institutional nonprofit power structure. It compared, you know, I came from doing work in Chicago for a dozen years when I came to Atlanta, and I was like, where's the resistance? Where's the opposition to the kind of corporate regime-led city government? Because it's in Chicago, too. But in Chicago and many other cities, especially older cities, non-southern cities, there's a stronger kind of organizing history and an advocacy history that you don't see, especially around housing and real estate issues. I would say I think that may be changing some. Especially in the last few years, really almost since I was, while I was writing the book. And a couple of things. One, I think that there's a stronger set of housing advocates that have come together in some coalition, both kind of tenant advocates like Housing Justice League, grassroots advocates like Community Movement Builders, but also newer kind of more mainstream groups like Abundant Housing Atlanta. And unlike in some other places, I see them kind of coalescing around agendas like let's make corporate real estate taxes, you know, owners pay fair share. And that's a good sign. The other thing, to be honest, and this is certainly controversial, I do think the opposition to Cop City has really catalyzed a bit of a sense of we can take the power structure on. We can question things. Now, a lot of folks haven't, and I understand that, but it's, you know, when you get 100,000 signatures or whatever that real number is, you know, even if it is only 60,000 signatures, that's a ton in a city of 200,000 households, right? So you're talking about, I mean, that's more votes. That's more than the mayor got elected by. So you're talking about a serious kind of questioning of what people call the Atlanta way, which is really what I mean by the corporate regime. This very kind of unquestioning, I'll use a strong word, almost co-optation of of groups that probably should be questioning things more. Like, why are we taxing Pont City Market at, you know, as if it's only worth a few hundred thousand dollars? when it's one of the most valuable real estate.
Than that in a day, I think.
So I do. I am more optimistic than I was when I wrote the book, to be honest.
Hey guys, if you're feeling challenged by these conversations in our Voices from the Field series and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. We would love to bring FCS's experience to your neighborhood. Place-based work is complex and multifaceted, so don't go at it alone. Whether it's some one-on-one coaching or walking with us through our two-year multi-sector cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you. So reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
Yeah, it is interesting, I think, about the history of community and relational organizing so baked into the story of Chicago. Like, you can't think of Chicago without thinking of that history versus Atlanta, which, like, you can't think of, like, the civil rights movement writ large without thinking about Atlanta. But, like, when you pull it back down to, like, the neighborhoods of Atlanta, the lack of that, like, just granular organizing presence to, like, why has that been missing here?
It's an excellent question. Right. And people have, other people besides me, I write about it some in the book, but other people have too. I mean, the civil rights movement took on issues of schools, public mm-hmm. accommodations, you know, access to restaurants, voting rights, mm-hmm. of course, but housing was dealt yeah. with differently, at least yeah. by the mainstream yeah. civil rights groups. There were some yeah. folks who advocated yeah. for more housing, especially in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. the black community power structure basically said, we are desperately in need of housing, mm-hmm. and they basically said, we'll take segregated housing if that's what we get. Yeah. And there, to yeah. some degree, was this, again, co-optation. And mm-hmm. so you saw the black community, the black power structure, at least the mainstream, with the exception, I think, of the NAACP, which was really committed to fair housing. Mm-hmm. And the planning department, you know, the kind of mainstream, and say, okay, here's where we're going to put black folks. We're going to put mm-hmm. them, you know, in these neighborhoods. I mean, mm-hmm. that was kind of clearly illegal, especially yeah. after the Fair Housing Act. But it was accepted because, mm-hmm. you know, the fight was about these other issues. To some degree, yeah. Maynard Jackson tried to push back on that, but yeah. he capitulated. I mean, mm-hmm. the corporate power structure said, don't do that. You know, yeah. we'll give you access to airport concessions for black entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll let you have that stuff. But when it comes to housing and neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Segregation yeah. was really well maintained by that black yeah. regime, the Atlanta regime. So I do think there was, you know, like you say, civil mm-hmm. rights organizing, very strong in Atlanta, mm-hmm. but community development organizing, not so yeah. much.
Yeah, yeah. It is just fascinating to think about, were there any other cities in the South in that era that had the global superpowers of like Coca-Cola to reckon with, right? You know, like it's just to think about, there's a level of like global financial power.
Yeah.
Even, you know, 60 years ago, you know, in the city, that's not just marketing their products around the world or even around the United States, but it's a massive economic force here, and how that influences.
Yeah, that is a very good question. I mean, eventually Charlotte with its banking power, mm-hmm. Dallas and Houston, you know, if you mm-hmm. consider them Southern, Miami is mm-hmm. kind of a weird anomaly yeah. Yeah. city, but I think you're right. I mean, Atlanta rising as the kind of capital power base in the South, you know, and yeah. you know, the role of Delta and Coke and other big wow. players, really important.
Yeah, you know, it makes, you know, when I think about, as you talk about, in the vein of all this, like this excessive catering to capital, even when we didn't have to, like, it's one thing to like beg, borrow, and steal just to get a business to come when right. when the city is emptying out of its population, but in an era where like people are, you know, in droves moving back into the city, we're still kind of doing that. And it makes me just think about the way we think about taxes as part of the problem. Because like when we talk about tax breaks to Ponce City Market or anybody else, like, I don't think we read money's being taken away from the public. Like, that's the most people to say, oh, well, a tax break is just an incentive. It's not like we're losing anything. We're just not paying something, right? So, I mean, like, how would you frame maybe a different way of thinking about what's when we say tax break for that business to come, what are we deciding is or isn't going to happen when we do that?
Excellent. And it, a big theme of the book is, you know, Atlanta grew in terms of wealth, and yet this kind of fake austerity, because it chose not to tax and to incentivize, which is a choice not to tax, in the face of that. And the irony is the people who bear the most of the downside of growth because of land values rising are low-income renters. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. yet, you know, they're bearing the costs, and they're not getting anything out of it because services and affordable housing aren't mm-hmm. keeping up. Mm-hmm. But I think that's exactly right. This, you basically have two effects of both tax incentives and general undertaxation of corporate property, mm-hmm. you have the tax shift problem, which is, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to maintain, you know, the city is growing. It's got to provide some level of services, even if mm-hmm. it's shortchanging them. And so you can't really cut spending because the city's growing. You can grow it more slowly than it should be. And so if these guys don't pay taxes, guess who does? You know, mm-hmm. the homeowners, the owners of smaller rental properties, which is, by the way, where a lot of low-income people live. So they pay higher taxes. That, by the way, they don't get homestead exemptions or some of the protections that homeowners are getting. So they especially are going to pay higher taxes. And so you're going to kind of encourage them to sell their property because it's not making, you know, they can't afford the taxes or raise the rents. So you're exacerbating the property more. So that's the tax shift problem. So, and this is Julian Benet, who's a local gadfly critic of how of property tax breaks in Atlanta, always makes his point. You know, somebody is going to pay for this every time you do it. But the other part is you're not able to grow your public resources that you need to as land values are going up and population's going up. You got to pay for the schools. You got to pay for sidewalks. You got to pay for infrastructure. And ideally, since low-income people are hitting, being hit the hardest, you should be paying for some affordable housing for the people who are being hit the hardest by this, right? You should be. And you know, what I didn't do in the book, which I probably should have, is to say this does happen in one city at least, and it happens in a few. New York City has, as it became, you know, the financial capital of the world in the 20th century, it spent some of its own money on affordable housing. And it's having problems now because certain mayors in the last 30 years stopped doing that, you know, and governors. But it built up probably the strongest affordable housing system in the U.S. by investing its own corporate property tax revenue into affordable housing. And it was able to, you know, so it was able to take, okay, we got this federal money. We're going to layer on top of it local money. And you know, I've got colleagues at NYU who say, well, we've seen lots of gentrification, but a lot, but not always that much displacement. And I'm like, well, that's because 20% of the neighborhoods are affordable housing. If you go into low-income neighborhoods in New York, if you go into the Bronx, there are neighborhoods that are 40% affordable housing. Those neighborhoods, if they gentrify, are not going to see nearly as much displacement or exclusion because they've built in so much affordable housing at in a substantial scale so that it's not just 3 or 5% of the housing stock. It's 20% of the housing stock or 30% of the housing stock. And so if you believe in long-term diverse neighborhoods, that's the you know, I always say the magic recipe is long-term affordable housing.
And it's interesting when, you know, groups visit FCS pretty frequently and like, well, inevitably gentrification comes up as the topic. And of course the question is like, well, how do we prevent this, stop this, slow this? And then like, in many ways, it's like a bad news conversation. It's like, well, if it's already unleashed in your neighborhood or city, and you've not already kind of done the work to like, to build, protect, and preserve affordable ownership, right? That that it can't be taken by, you know, a landlord.
Right.
Then I don't know what you do other than like it's going to pay twice as much to get those units, make them affordable, and lose it. Like that, it has to be built in. That like even our own method of neighborhood work, like we don't, we believe in mixed income diverse neighborhoods, but we you can't start with, you know, let's bring more market rate housing into the neighborhoods. Like you have to start by protecting
and this is life. This is why, I mean, I'm really happy that the Beltline organization and the city, particularly around the Beltline, are like, we're starting to acquire property. We're starting, you know, we're doing more affordable housing. We're spending, you know, tens of millions instead of, less than, really paltry amounts in the first 20 years or 15 years. It's great. But imagine what that could have done at the beginning, and I
those
was
same dollars would have gone so much further. Would have bought.
I did a study that I cite in the book in 2007 saying you should be buying and mm-hmm. That was at when property values were just starting to decline because of the crash. And I know they brought John Davis in to talk about land trust, but they really didn't do anything. And they say, well, we couldn't, we had the lawsuits and but they built the parks. They built they subsidized Ponce City Market out the wazoo. They did lots of things that, and to their credit, they were advised to, meaning if you look at the Emerald Necklace report and other things, they were advised, start with the parks, start with the things that will increase land values. And I'm like, no, start with the things to acquire land. Before you increase land values. And they just didn't do it. But, the good news is at least they've acknowledged, at least some folks have acknowledged that, and they are, whether it's due to public pressure or other things, they are doing more, but it's at a,
it's at a premium now.
Yeah. I mean, what they paid for the Pittsburgh Yards property, if what they could have, because I did work for Casey in 2010 around there, and houses were selling for $15,000.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Even our own, in a few short, it feels like a few short years. I remember, it was not that far on the other side of the pandemic where, like, one of the first houses in our neighborhood sold for it breached the 200,000 level, and our minds were blown. We're like, holy cow. Can't believe this. And now, like, if you can buy an unlivable, blighted, falling apart, house that's, vacant, blighted on a fairly small parcel, that's already you're almost at $200,000 just to get a hold of it at this point, right? And that's in a neighborhood that is not, an east side neighborhood, right? It's still pretty under the radar neighborhood. It's like, oh man. Like, and so that becomes like the conversation with our guests who visit is like, the bad news is whoever owns the land and the assets is going to kind of determine your story, right? And like, unless we have the right kind of people owning at enough of a volume, then it is going to be market, which isn't blind, right? It's good, but it's a forceful kind of decisive reality that becomes a different thing altogether when we ignore it. So there's one of the, like, you talk about inflection points, Beltline being one of them. Another one is like, with the predatory subprime lending, the foreclosure crisis that follows. After that, there's a lot of corporate investment in single family homes to turn them to rentals. Like, talk a bit about that as a series of decisions that are being made that has increased inequity in Atlanta.
Yeah, Atlanta was referred to by one of the largest private equity single family rental firms, not too long, around 2012, when this stuff really took off, as an ideal strike zone. Lots of foreclosures, and this is not just city, this is regional, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of foreclosures, job growth still, or at least expected job growth. This is 2012, so jobs are starting to come back. In a state with certainly no threat of rent control, but also no real threat of stronger tenant protections, at least in the near term. So those combinations of things, job growth, lots of foreclosures to buy, and landlord-friendly policies, really, and these guys are big, so they wanted big metros, right? They didn't they wanted to get kind of economies of scale and maybe market power, right? So that, I've had colleagues who've done interviews in Henry County where there's been a lot of buying more recently, and there are tenants who said, I can only rent from Blackstone, from Invitation Homes. That's about the only thing. Yeah. I mean, there are 50% of the homes in my school district or my school zone that are available. So it's that, you know, and that was a, I partly picked that story because it was really important for growing southern cities because it's happened in a number of them, but also because it's a confluence of bad federal policy with bad local policy, meaning the feds really encouraged the large private equity investors to go in and buy foreclosed homes because they were worried about what it was doing to the housing market and particularly to the asset, to the balance sheets of the people who owned all these foreclosed properties, to the banks. So they put the interest of the banks, unfortunately, ahead of the interests of the neighborhoods with the foreclosed properties. And they literally, in this paper I cite, they literally say, well, we can either focus really on helping folks buy these homes for owner occupancy, and that's going to be tough because credit markets are really tight, mortgage markets were really tight at the time, or we can, you know, foster these big guys to come in and institutionalize this as single family rental. And you know, maybe the first choice was the harder choice, but I think it would have been the right choice. I mean, at the same time, which I don't talk as much about in the book, but I talk about in some of my other writing, we had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were under government conservatorship, basically issuing what were called declining market policies, which were going to make it they were making it harder for folks to buy homes in places that had had lots of foreclosures, even harder than it already was. So we had them doing that. That was like 2010. Fortunately, fair housing advocates pushed back pretty hard on that. But then they gave us something kind of not quite as clearly redlining, but still to me, something called loan level pricing, risk-based pricing, which we still have and still works against particularly black communities. But these federal policies came in, and you know, there was that interacts with state policies that don't provide any kind of protection for renters and just made Atlanta. And then a couple years before that, we had the neighborhood stabilization programs coming out of the federal government. It wasn't nearly enough money, a few billion dollars, which at the time people were like, oh, that's a lot of money. It's not. I mean, given the scale of how many homes. But the other problem was Atlanta, to what you say, Atlanta localities, including the city, but also the suburbs, mostly, I'm not going to say misspent, but use that money unwisely. The goal was mostly get those homes reoccupied. And so a lot of places, especially the suburbs, but also the city, just focused on trying to help people buy the homes. There was no consideration for long-term affordability, for, you know, if we subsidize this and they flip the house in 5 years, do we recapture the subsidy at least? There was none of that. It was just all about, we don't want vacant homes. So were there all, you know, thousands of homes in the city. I talk about this in the context of Pittsburgh in some writing, the Pittsburgh neighborhood. You know, any Casey had started buying homes during the crisis. And then they bought a couple hundred and they stopped, partly because of change in leadership at the foundation. And I was consulting to them and I was like, don't stop. You're getting homes at $20,000 a crack. The market's going to come back. Don't stop, because instead of 200 homes, they could have had 600 homes. And they could have really changed the dynamic of that neighborhood in the long term. So it was that goes down to the neighborhood level. There were just a series of missed opportunities during that period. And then, again, the Beltline had an opportunity to reset and acquire properties at very low prices. And it was, again, this missed opportunity. But it was the part of the... It was not just a missed opportunity for, we couldn't get those properties at low prices. It was a missed opportunity that led to institutional investors and mid-size investors getting a control of a huge number of properties that could have been done for use for long-term affordable rental instead of just market rental, or long-term affordable home ownership.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating, you know, the paper that you cite, that just to see it in print, just to, like, we are where we are from decisions being made.
Yeah.
Neighborhoods are the product of intentional forces, not accident. Like, we don't have neighborhoods of concentrated disadvantage by accident or by a bunch of individuals just making bad
That's
decisions.
Right. Like, that's just, right.
They say, like, we had a choice to prioritize, like, banking real estate interest, or to prioritize, like, lower income residents in a neighborhood. And, like, we made a choice then. And so, I mean, it's part of this idea of, like, how do we, you know, Atlanta's 175-ish years into kind of this regime, and what we're used to doing, decisions we're used to making. As you think about the next 20 or the next 175, as you think about the next phase of Atlanta's life, what do we do next? Like, what kind of decisions do we need to be making so that, you know, somebody's not having the same conversation 50 years out, and whatever the version of podcasts is 50 years from now? Like, what are the things we need to be doing as a city, individuals should be advocating for? Like, what are the decisions that ought to be happening now that are realistic, right, that really are
sure.
on the table for future equity?
Sure. So in the city of Atlanta, I think the most if I put one at the top, it would be this corporate taxation, corporate property taxation. We basically undertax large corporate real estate on the order of 40 to 50%, meaning they pay about half the property taxes they ought to be paying, and on top of that, we subsidize some of them. That so one is the effective tax rate, which is really a problem of the rubber stamp property tax appeals process that you know, most homeowners don't use, because it's not, you know, they can't afford one of these consultants, or it wouldn't be worth it for them to hire them. But if you have a $100 million building, then you're going to pay somebody, and you're going to get this lower tax rate. So fixing that problem, and this has been a problem well known for at least 5 or 6 years, but really longer. The mayor at a public event about a year ago said he was going to take a stab at it. I have not seen any significant progress on this. There's been study after study on it. There is advocacy around it. This new kind of coalition of different groups around housing have taken it on. Paired with that, though, is even if that happens, where will that money go? My fear is it will go to lower the taxes of more affluent homeowners. And that's not where it needs to go. It needs to be devoted to affordable housing, to basic city services, hopefully not, I mean, in my opinion, not to more police, or at least not substantially more. So there's both the revenue side and the spending side of that problem. But this is, you know, this is a, goes right at the heart of the urban regime. Right? Because the property owners are the corporate part of that urban regime. And it's not, people are like, oh, this is a no-brainer, we should just do it. Like, no, it's not that easy. But it is possible. It's about activism. It's about organizing. It's about policy. It's definitely doable, at least incrementally. And that could generate tens of millions of dollars, actually probably over $100 million of new city revenue on a budget of about $800 million. That's a lot of money. You know, if you increase the city budget by $100 million, that's a lot of money. And then that also would affect the schools. It would be a couple hundred million dollars for Atlanta Public Schools. So that would be on the top of my list. Other ones that I think, you know, there is a chance for a modest improvement in tenant protections at the state level. There was a bill that made it through the House last year, the Georgia House. It's in the Senate now. It's still alive. There was a lot of advocacy last year. It would provide some, it would, for the first time, Georgia is one of the few states where there is no legal requirement for landlords to provide habitable housing. It sounds absurd, but yeah. it actually is the case. And mm-hmm. it would, for the first time, do that, not as strongly as it should, but to me, that's the camel's nose on, and that's why there's so much opposition, going to be opposition, but it's the camel's nose on making tenant protection stronger. And, you know, related to that, the kind of third thing is stronger tenant organizing statewide. Mm-hmm. And low-income homeowner organizing. But what, you know, housing is just not on the radar of most state legislators or even many city council people because tenants aren't organized. And Atlanta, I mean, Housing Justice League does good work. There's some other folks doing good work. But Atlanta is, you know, kind of on the bottom of the list of large cities and especially large metros without kind of somewhat powerful tenant organizing and housing organizing. And to get those issues on the radar of the moderate legislator, you're not going to probably win over the, you know, the landlord legislator, because there are a good number of those. But there are folks who it's just not on their radar. And they're in the suburbs, too. They're not just, meaning there's lots of issues in the suburbs, and the organizing can't just be in the city of Atlanta. It's too small politically.
What do you feel like is the role of, there's been some nationwide momentum around doing away with exclusionary zoning. How much do you feel like that is necessary, or what weight does that carry if we want to think about a more affordable, equitable, healthy city, especially at a neighborhood level? How much does changing single family zoning have to do with changing this?
I think it's really important. I think it's really important for not just market rate housing, but for affordable housing. You know, it's, if you talk to many of my former students who are developing low income housing tax credit buildings, you know, the cost of doing that and the choices they're making about, you know, do we think about doing one in Dunwoody? Do we think one doing one on the north side of the city? You know, they don't even consider certain places because of the opposition and because of the lack of land that's available. So I think that's huge. I also think that missing middle, you know, smaller units is part of the mix. Especially in the suburbs, that's really hard to do, but also on the north side and the northeast side. I think Atlanta's in a better position than lots of more affluent cities in terms of, you know, it's kind of more feasible, but we still need more. But the real, you know, if there's just a study out of the Pew Foundation that I posted on LinkedIn, if you're going to deal with rapid inflows of young, highly educated folks with significant incomes, you got to build multifamily. And I mean, that's where you need to absorb. And missing middle's fine, but a lot of the folks moving in that are driving up rents and having the kind of crowding out of affordable housing because everyone wants to build market rate, you've got to allow for, and Atlanta, compared to many cities, has done quite well on that. You know, we had 10,000 multifamily permits in 2022 in a city of 200,000 households. That's a lot of construction. The key, I think, is to match that, you know, to make sure that that is built in good locations for folks, particularly for affordable housing. It needs to be built near transit. And I think we've been a laggard in our transit-oriented development, affordable housing. I feel like MARTA has not been nearly as aggressive as, you know, I look to Chicago right now for doing a lot on what's called equitable TOD. And that is zoning change matched with subsidy. And that's what I think, you know, for low-income people, that's particularly important. I have no problems with increasing overall aggregate supply. And yes, will it trickle down? Well, it does free up housing as folks move into the newer stuff, but the housing's still not affordable, Right. So people move out of older multifamily into the new stuff, higher income, new folks. And you say, well, that makes available units for loan. Well, it's still, okay, it's going to be $2,200 for a two-bedroom minimum, even for an older unit. That's not affordable for a low-income family. So it may open up more units, but you still need a deliberate, subsidized, affordable housing for those folks. So it's the match between zoning and subsidy that I think is key. At least if we want to be a city where low-income folks are welcome. Which sometimes I'm not sure everyone wants that.
And I think that's what I think I identified most with in Red Hot City is just the maybe it's a voice crying in the wilderness to say, like, when we think about judging the health of our city, you know, the success of our city, that metric should be geared from the perspective of the less powerful, right? That if this is only a hub that includes the group that always gets included or continues to reap more and more benefits from that economy, then what are we, right? And I think, like, if we, it's one thing to be really proud that we're the birthplace of Dr. King and we're the bed of the civil rights movement. You know, like, it's great to honor that history, right, and to celebrate it. But it's another thing to say, does this city represent the beloved community that was dreamed about? And if we can't say that and while at the same time be fighting against zoning or other legislations that would keep low-income residents out.
It's also brings up the question, your comment also brings up the question of, okay, well, we're gentrifying as a city. Isn't that better than having the old concentrated poverty model of the 60s and 70s? And I'm like, you know, think about it. What is gentrification if it goes to its penultimate? It's just resegregation. You know, you're gentrifying the core of the city. You're going to create concentrated affluence in the core, which we have done in some neighborhoods. And then you're displacing or excluding folks, low-income folks, to the suburbs where they, you know, so now the old saying was chocolate city, vanilla suburb. So is vanilla city chocolate suburb better? And in many ways, I would argue no, because folks are going to be farther from transit. They're going to be farther from the downtown jobs, which, by the way, are often public sector, educational, more accessible. And they're going to be farther from Grady and lots of other services that they depend on.
And I think that's the, to me, like, we need to stop trying to, like, solve a housing problem and try to start solving neighborhood problems. Like, we need to begin with what is a vibrant, thriving, equitable, just, healthy neighborhood, and then how do we build from there versus just like, oh, we're just trying to get units filled, or even just let's build more affordable housing can often just be kind of a myopic thing. It's like, what we want is neighborhoods where, regardless of income, you have access to opportunity. Like, you belong, right? You have agency and power within this context. And that work of let's move in that direction. Thank you, and man, just for your work, for this time today. Anybody who's listening, if you care about Atlanta as a city, about equity, about justice, about housing reform, read Red Hot City. But more than that, just follow Dan on LinkedIn. Get on LinkedIn. Read his research. Read what's going on. There's just so much good stuff there. I benefit on a regular basis, and so I'm just appreciative of your work in general, the book specifically, and definitely for this conversation today. So thank you. Thank you so much for being an ally.
Thank you. This was a great conversation. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, thank you so much.
If you have benefited from this conversation, I would encourage you to pick up Red Hot City, Housing, Race, and Exclusion in 21st Century Atlanta, wherever books are sold. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.